Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The cost of college seems to get more expensive each year. Student loan debt is debilitating millions of Americans, and we hear stories of graduates burdened with debt and unable to find work. How did we get to this place? And more importantly, how do we find our way out? Paul Tough is a journalist and author. His recent book is The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul Tough joins us from the WGBH studios in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So when those of us over the age of 40 were thinking about college, even if we were middle or low income, it seemed possible. Yet we'd have to take out loans, but there wasn't a concern we'd be burdened with tens of thousands of dollars of debt or not be able to go to college at all. That's not the case today. So why has college become so expensive?
Well, the short answer when it comes to public universities, which is where most American students go, and certainly most low-income students, is that the public has stopped paying for them. We have really shifted the burden of public higher education from the public to students, to individuals, to families. And that, to my mind, just goes against the basic premise of higher education. That's had two effects. One is it has meant, especially among community colleges, that we just they have less to work with. And so they spend less on student supports and advising and all the things that can help students succeed. But then it also means that tuition has gone up because they've had to make up that money from somewhere else.
Does where we go to college make a difference in our earnings later in life?
It does. I mean, you know, for any individual, it's hard to say this college is absolutely better than that college. But when you look at the data in the aggregate, there's no question that the more selective the institution you go to, the more likely you are to earn big salaries. This Harvard economist named Raj Chetty did a big report a couple of years ago called the Mobility Report Cards, where he used tax data going back generations to analyze exactly how likely you were to earn what kind of salary, depending on both your own background and what kind of institution you went to. And he found this very clear correlation between the more selective the institution you went and how much you were earning as an adult.
What are some of the reasons earning expectations are so different depending on the college we attend?
It's a hard question to disentangle. I think there is, like, these institutions, these selective institutions do have a lot more money to spend, and they do spend it on you. So another economist named Carolyn Hawksby did this remarkable study where she found that the most selective institutions are spending $150,000 and $200,000 per student. So despite these high tuition rates that we're hearing about, they are actually losing significant amounts of money on every student that they educate. And their theory, and they're probably right, is that they're going to make that back later on when these alumni graduates become wealthy alumni and then donate to the college. So those institutions are spending a whole lot on their students, and less selective institutions are spending a lot less. So I think that's part of it. Part of it is a real valuable education. But I think then it's also about the connections, about the sort of social capital that you get from being around other students who come from similarly affluent backgrounds. There's a way that the most selective colleges now enroll so many affluent, high-income students that they have become these sort of gathering places for people who already have a lot of influence and power, and that that gets shared and transferred from one student to another.
You mentioned highly selective schools spending, $150,000 per student per year. Is that per student spending indicative of the quality of the education?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, I think there's an urge to just say no, right? Mm-hmm. To just say they're wasting money, they're doing all sorts of crazy stuff with it. I resist that because, I don't want to say that these institutions are so fantastic, but they really do give a remarkably valuable education to their students. They spend a lot of money on very, very good professors. They have, beautiful facilities. They are remarkable places. And so that does not mean that you cannot get an excellent education at a student that's spending less money, and that those colleges aren't wasting some of that money. But I think, our urge to say, they're just wasting it, you can get the same education anywhere, it distracts us from the fact that there are these sort of systemic inequities in higher education. Yeah. And the fact that, these institutions are spending a whole lot of money on already wealthy students gets to some sort of deep unfairnesses in how the system works.
So how can a school spend more in educating a student than they receive in tuition? It seems like a business model that wouldn't succeed over time.
You would think. So Carolyn Hoxie, this economist, calls it the dynasty model. And her theory is that, and again, I think she's right, that these graduates will go on and in, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 years, they'll make such huge piles of money that they will give a lot back to their institution. And there's a lot of evidence that that is true. You know, these most selective institutions have enormous endowments, and those endowments seem to grow every year. I wrote in the book about a fundraising campaign that Harvard undertook a few years ago. It was the biggest fundraising campaign in the history of higher education. They had this crazy goal that they wanted to make $6.5 billion over 5 years. No one thought they could possibly do it, and they made it in 2.5 years. Wow. And they ended up within 5 years bringing in $9.6 billion. So Harvard alumni seem to be perfectly happy to write checks for hundreds of millions of dollars to this institution, which is then educating lots more rich kids. Yeah. Like that.
So if these selective schools are counting on alumni donations down the road to make up the difference in per student expenditure and tuition, is it fair to say that it isn't in their best business interest for them to admit low to middle income students, since it's likely that despite their increased earning potential later in life, they won't be in that position to contribute as much?
No, I would argue against that, because I think that those low-income students, and in fact there's evidence from that Raj Chetty study, those low-income students, if they do get that kind of excellent education, do go on to make tons of money as well. And if they do, I would argue they would be exceptionally grateful to
Very
the
thankful,
institution
yeah.
of how higher education they attended. So I don't think there is a lot of sense in a business direction.
As you note in the book, the earning difference for attending a selective college will have the most impact on middle and low-income students. So if we're looking for a way to help close the income gap, this would be a great place to start. But the application process for selective schools is titled in favor of the wealthy. Tell us how.
Yeah, I think that's true in all kinds of ways. I mean, at the institutions that aren't at the very most selective with these giant endowments, but are still, you know, highly selective liberal arts colleges. The big reason that they favor wealthy students so much is that they've got to bring in tuition dollars. So, you know, some of those institutions work on that dynasty model. Others just work on a basic tuition model where they need to stay afloat by getting those tuition checks. And in fact, a lot of American colleges, four-year private nonprofit institutions, are in real financial trouble right now. About a quarter of them are losing money each year, and many others are quite close to that line. So that's part of it, that admissions officials need to admit rich kids just to pay the bills. But there are also other more hidden factors in the application process, like early admissions, which more and more colleges are admitting a lot of their students via early admissions. And early admissions favors wealthy students who don't need to weigh a lot of different financial aid offers in the spring, like a lot of lower income and middle income students do. Even sports. One of the things that really struck me in my reporting was that when colleges, especially small private colleges, recruit athletes, they are not recruiting athletes who play the sort of sports that you can play without a big investment as a kid. They're recruiting, you know, fencers and golfers and squash players and tennis players, all young people who do the sorts of sports that you do in prep school. So that's just another kind of hidden advantage that the affluent students get in the process.
In the book, you talk with a college test prep tutor who is the go-to person in the D.C. area for those who can afford him. Tell us more about his strategies to improve student test scores.
Yeah, that's another hidden advantage for sure. So his name is Ned Johnson. He runs his own company in D.C. called Prep Matters. And he's really good at his job. I watched him work for a while, and he raises his students' test scores by remarkable degrees. And as a result, he charges a lot. It's $400 an hour is his base price. It was fascinating watching him work. One of the reasons was that, you know, I expected for $400 an hour that he was going to be delivering a lot of important content information to these students, talking a lot about algebra and polynomials and reading comprehension strategies. But in fact, most of the time he was talking to his students about life, about stress, about what it's like to be, a well-off student in an ambitious, stress-filled family. And his theory is that for most of the students, you know, who have super-educated parents and are going to really good schools, the kind of students who would end up in his office, their problems are not really academic. The things that are holding them back from great test scores are mostly about their anxiety. Mm. And when you put a whole lot of pressure on these tests, paradoxically, you tend to do worse because you get stressed out. When you get stressed out, Ned has read a lot of stress physiology and psychology. He understands that it's harder to concentrate, it's harder to focus. And so one of the things he does is talk to them about sleep and exercise and having a balanced sort of schedule. But he also tries to persuade them that these tests, the SAT and the ACT, are not actually something they should take that seriously. That seems kind of crazy because they're paying $400 an hour to take it very seriously. But in fact, he says, these don't measure your real ability. They don't measure who you are. They don't measure your worth in the world. They're just these goofy little collections of tricks, and I'm going to show you how to defeat them. And that helps in lots of ways. But one of the ways it helps is it just lowers their stress level. They no longer take it as seriously. And so, oddly enough, they do better.
There have been attempts to offer test prep to a wider range of students. Tell us more about those efforts and if they're effective.
So the big one is this collaboration that started a few years ago between the College Board, which runs the SAT, and Khan Academy, the online learning system. And I write a lot about this collaboration. I went out to Khan Academy and talked to Sal Khan, who started Khan Academy. I talked to David Coleman, the head of the College Board, about it. And in lots of ways, I think it's a great undertaking. If you are a high school student, a junior or a senior, you can link your Khan Academy account with your College Board account and get a test prep that is designed to fill in the gaps in your knowledge. So that's really valuable, I think, in all kinds of ways. My complaint about it, as I write in the book, is that when the College Board presented the data from their first couple of years of this collaboration back in 2017, they chose ways of releasing the data that made it seem more effective than it really was. And the problem with official SAT practice, as is the problem with a lot of interventions, is that it is actually used more by rich kids, by advantaged kids, by kids whose parents have lots of education, than by more disadvantaged kids. And so on the whole, it is doing more to widen the gaps rather than shrink them. That's something that they can take on by finding ways to get low-income disadvantaged students to use it more, but they left a lot of those details out when they presented that information.
And many of the low- to middle-income students interested in college are sometimes the first generation of their family to do so. So what are some of the ways we can offer better supports for them to choose and apply to colleges?
There have been a number of interventions over the last few years that have been aimed specifically at first-generation students, and especially this category of low-income, high-achieving students. And I think one of the things that sort of pulls together a lot of these interventions is that they have a psychological component to them. So, there's kind of this debate within that community about whether students who are not applying to the most selective institutions they could apply to, whether it's just a question of information, whether they just need more information about where they could get in and what kind of financial aid they could get. And there certainly is an information deficit. There are a lot in high poverty high schools. There are very few college counselors and very few counselors who know a lot about the most highly selective institutions. So I talked to lots of students along the way who said, no one at my high school really helped me figure out what to do about college, and no one in my family could help me either. But I think there's evidence that the information side of it is only one part of it. And I spent some time with a few different families, but one family in particular in western North Carolina, this rural, low-income family, where the daughter in the family, a young woman named Kim, was a high school senior and was trying to get to a good college. And so she certainly did have some information deficits, and she didn't have enough support at her college. But her real obstacle was that her family didn't think that she should go to college, and they were constantly sort of talking her down and talking the idea of college down and telling her she should just join the military or go to work or have babies. And that was really hard for her. You know, I think it was hard for her just because it's hard to argue against your family, but also because it hurt on some level, you know, not to have their support.
Now, listeners may remember when Harvard University initiated a policy to admit qualified low and middle income students tuition free. Sounds like a wonderful offer. How did the demographics of the Harvard student body change after that policy?
Not very much. So that was President Larry Summers, I think back in 2004, who initially introduced that policy. When economists studied the effect of it, they showed that the number of low-income students in Harvard's freshman class went up by 15 or 20 individuals. It didn't make a big difference. And that was kind of, in some ways, the beginning of this push to try to figure out what it would take to get more low-income students to attend highly selective institutions. And there is still a big debate going on right now because the numbers haven't moved much at any of these institutions, despite lots of, at the very least, sort of public pronouncements about how these institutions want more low-income students.
So what are some of the reasons more students didn't apply for that program?
Well, I think lots of them did apply, but I think part of the obstacle is actually not on the level of the students, it's on the level of the institutions. That these institutions, one of the obstacles, I think, is that they do take test scores so seriously, whether it's because they genuinely believe in them or because they understand that the U.S. News College rankings take test scores very seriously, and if you admit more students with lower test scores, your U.S. News ranking will fall. But the reality is test scores correlate very strongly with family income. If you just look at students' high school grades, which many analysts say are a better indicator of how well a student will do in college, there is much less of an income disparity. So if colleges really care a lot about keeping their test scores high, it is going to be harder for them to admit more low-income students. And I think that has a lot to do with why things haven't changed.
At the selective schools, low-income and minority students who make it through the application process and are accepted sometimes feel like outsiders once they get there. And you talked with a student named Kiki at Princeton. Tell us more about her and her experiences.
Yeah, Kiki's one of my favorite students to spend time with. I met her when she had just finished her junior year of high school, and so sort of followed her through her senior year of high school in North Carolina, and then into Princeton and through her freshman year. She is a great student, very focused on academics, but came from a low-income, kind of chaotic household. So when she got to, she's African-American, when she got to Princeton, she had expected, she knew she was going to be different from a lot of students at Princeton, but she expected to have some kind of community there, other students like her, sort of struggling African-American students from generational poverty who were these academic superstars, and finally she would find her community. But when she got to Princeton, she found that while there were a significant number of African-American students there, they were almost entirely not low-income. Many of them were from immigrant backgrounds rather than backgrounds of generational poverty like her, and that the low-income students who she did meet who had backgrounds that echoed hers were more likely to be white or Latino or Latina. And so, and she also just felt like there were very few truly low-income students there, and that most of the students who were eligible for financial aid were actually sort of working class or middle class. And so all of that was kind of jarring to her. I mean, I think going to a highly selective institution like Princeton for any student who is from even a modest economic background is really jarring because there just is so much money, so much wealth, so much privilege. And that's sort of a culture shock. It's just, you know, there are references you don't understand. There's clothing and food and vacations that people are talking about that you don't know about. But I think it's also jarring almost on kind of a political level that you understand for the first time how the world works and how privilege perpetuates itself. And for students like Kiki, it just makes them mad. And it takes up a lot of their thought processes in those first couple of years.
So what do you think are some of the ways colleges can better support low-income and minority students once they are admitted?
Well, I think there are lots of things that they can do. So I wrote a lot about the University of Texas, which has made some remarkable strides over the last few years in supporting their low-income and first-generation students. And what's striking to me about what they did is that the interventions weren't particularly imaginative. I mean, they were good, they were smart, but they kind of had a common sense aspect to them. There's this school of research in psychology that talks about the process of belonging and how feelings of belonging are both helped and hindered, especially in freshman year of college. And when students are in this kind of this moment of sort of belonging uncertainty, and freshman year is one of them, they're very susceptible to messages about belonging, either positive or negative messages. And they hear a lot of those messages. They hear, you know, you don't get along with a roommate, you fail a test, you're talking to your mom and she says, well, why don't you just come home and go to the community college here? All of those things sort of add up in your mind and make you think, maybe I don't belong here. But when colleges are able to counteract that, not just with messages, but also with programs that create a sense of community, they can really reverse that trend. And so UT had a program called the Undergraduate Leadership Network. They got 1,200 of the most low-income students at UT together for their freshman year, gave them seminars, gave them a sense of community. Later on, after freshman year, connected them with internship opportunities that made them feel more connected to the university as a whole. And as a result, over the course of just a few years, they drastically improved their graduation rate, and especially their graduation rate for their most disadvantaged students.
Mm. Students admitted to the middle and lower tier colleges are often the students who are taking on debt to attend college, and unfortunately, the graduation rates at those colleges aren't as high as the upper tier or selective colleges. And of course, this means many students don't graduate but have student debt loan. So let's focus on the debt for a moment. Do you think students should take on debt to attend college? And if so, how do students and their families determine what is a reasonable amount of debt?
It's a really hard question to solve. I mean, the short answer is that yes, debt can be a useful investment. And so I worry that all of our fears about debt are going to push students too far in the opposite direction to say, like, college is just not worth it. I'm not going to take on any debt. And so most students who do have debt have about $20,000 or $30,000 in debt, which is a lot, but it is manageable if you have a BA. You know, your monthly payments are somewhere like $250 or $300, which is a drag, but it is not ruinous if you have the kind of job that you can get with a BA. So if that's going to be your level of debt, and if you're going to complete your degree, it's a good investment. The real debt problems come, well, first of all, what you identified, when students don't finish college, but also in the minority of students who take on debt that's just way beyond what makes sense. A lot of those students go to for-profit colleges. So the for-profit sector, you know, there are some good institutions in that sector, but there are a lot that over the past couple of decades have really preyed on students who feel the pressure from the economy to get some kind of credential, but don't necessarily understand the financial aid process, don't understand the difference between different institutions. And so those institutions, students can rack up, you know, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 worth of debt.
Yeah. So let's talk about how the student loan system works. Are schools offering loans, federal government loans, they're private bank loans, and I'm assuming there are predatory student loan practices?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what is so difficult for families to work out is that it's all of the above. So there are I can't say that I entirely understand the system, but there are, you know, there are federal grants, there is institutional aid, but then there are various levels of loans, and one of the sort of inherent problems with the system is that students whose families have lower credit ratings, which are quite likely to be the students who have the fewest resources. This young woman, Kim, I was talking about from North Carolina was one of them. They are forced to go into the marketplace for higher interest loans, right? So the students who can least afford to carry a big loan burden are often the ones who do end up going to more predatory lenders.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, I'm thinking about scholarships. I think there's so many different types, and you know, I think sometimes it becomes overwhelming for parents who are trying to look for a little bit of help here or there. But that's definitely an area worth investigating because there are just so many different types.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think the fact that there is aid out there that does not come either from the government or from the institution you're going to is that can be a great resource. And Kiki, the young woman we were talking about from Princeton, she was really good at that in her senior year. She applied to lots of these national programs that helped her get a whole slew of great scholarships.
Yeah.
It's useful. I mean, the thing that I learned about scholarships and grants that kind of blew my mind was how many of them are kind of just euphemisms for tuition discounts. So institutions themselves have been discounting their tuition more and more in recent years. So it's sort of the hidden fact of college tuition that at the same time that the list prices have been going up, the discounts that colleges offer have been going up as well. In other words, meaning mm-hmm. that net prices have been staying more or less flat. Mm. The problem with, so that's good that they're offering discounts. The average discount now just passed 50%. And so on average, students are paying half of what the list price is. The problem is that is just an average and that students are paying all different prices. If you look at the freshman class of any given college or university, the freshmen are paying, almost everyone is paying their own tuition price. And those tuition prices are calculated now by these outside consultants doing a thing called financial aid optimization using complex algorithms and giant computers that calculate exactly what you are worth to the institution and what the institution is worth to you. And so a lot, but when they present this discounted tuition to you, they don't say, okay, here's what you have to pay. They say, well, here's the list price, and then here is the scholarship that we're giving you.
Yeah.
And so you're really encouraged to think, wow, I just got, you know,
a
$30,000 check from this institution. I'm rich. But really, you know, I mean, it's just like it's what any retailer does, right?
Yeah.
They give you a big discount and they make you feel rich.
Yeah.
But in fact, you're still paying.
Yeah.
And when it comes to college, you're still paying kind of an enormous amount.
So what do graduation rates say about colleges? And is that an important thing to look at when considering which college to attend?
It's a very important thing to look at. I mean, because as you were saying, it does make a huge difference whether you graduate or not. If you go to the economics data makes clear that if you go to college and don't graduate, it has a much smaller impact, positive impact on your future earnings than graduating does. It really is important to get that diploma. And so colleges do post their graduation rates, and if a college has a particularly low graduation rate, that should be something of a red flag. The one sort of caveat to that I would point out is that graduation rates in some ways are very much connected to who gets admitted. So it's not necessarily true that, you know, a community college with a 20% graduation rate is doing a worse job with the resources they have than Princeton is with its 97% graduation rate. Part of the reason why Princeton has a high graduation rate is that they do have a lot of money to spend, and they spend it on, you know, tutors and advisors and therapists and everything else to help their students succeed, whereas the community college has very little of that.
Yeah.
But it's also because Princeton is admitting students who would be likely to succeed no matter what.
Right.
And so the fact that a community college has a low graduation rate doesn't necessarily mean that it can't work for you. If you are the kind of student who can work that system and figure out how to get the resources you need and graduate, it can be, you know, those 20% are doing great because a community college can be a great option. It's can be low tuition. There are great professors, great resources there. You just need to work a little harder to make it work for yourself.
There are a number of well-paying jobs that don't require a four-year degree. I'm thinking of the trades, plumbers, electricians, culinary arts. We know the earning potential for those who do go to college is higher than those who do not. But does that take into account those who pursue trades or certificate programs?
It does. And so I spent some time reporting on welding in particular, and I spent some time with a welding student at a community college in North Carolina. And one of the reasons that I chose to follow him was that welding has become this kind of repeated refrain in the political debate about college. And a few years ago, it started being held up, especially by conservative politicians, as this force that was the perfect alternative to college. You didn't have to go to college because you could become a welder. And there were a couple, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that said that welders were making $150,000 a year, and so forget about college. And there were two problems with it. As I spent more time reporting this, both reporting the economic data and also spending time with this student, there were two problems with this. One was that the problem with welding as an alternative to college is that you have to go to college to be a welder. So this young man, Ori, was in a two-year program. Welding is complicated. You know, plumbing is complicated, is too. Cooking certainly is. And all of these usually they're 2-year degrees, they are not easy. They involve a lot of skills and need a lot of training. And a lot of our community colleges where students are learning these trades are exactly the ones where we have cut funding and made it harder and harder for them to graduate. Mm-hmm. But the other problem about the idea of the wealthy welder is that actually welders not making $150,000 a year. The average salary for a welder in the United States is $41,000, which is not bad if you're just starting out, but most of those welders are, you know, men in their 40s and 50s trying to support families. So the way the economy has changed, you know, the skilled trades are actually under assault, and it's harder and harder to make a good living, and you do still need some kind of college.
Yeah. Now, for many years, it was common for students to pursue a liberal arts degree, but when we look at college from a purely economic standpoint, it makes sense that an investment of that much money should lead directly to a job. Is something lost in our society when fewer students pursue liberal arts degrees?
That's a good question. I mean, I was a liberal arts student, and so I'm in favor of students continuing to, you know, read books and study philosophy and poetry and all of those things. I guess here's the distinction that I would make. I think in the kind of knowledge economy that we live in today, those skills that can often seem sort of frivolous, the kind of skills that students are learning in a liberal arts degree, they are actually incredibly valuable in many workplaces. So Kiki at Princeton is a philosophy major. And so I spent some time with her in class watching her and her mostly wealthy counterparts sitting around tables debating ancient Roman writers. And what struck me watching them, and I had just been spending time with that welding student as well, is that, you know, when we watch a welding student at community college, we think this is job training, right? This guy is learning skills that are directly going to affect his income later on. But it struck me that sitting around that seminar table at Princeton, these students were doing exactly the same thing. You know, even though they were in a liberal arts class, they were learning how to analyze, how to read, how to debate, how to present their ideas, all of the kinds of things that in a modern knowledge economy, a high-paying office job, are exactly the skills you need. So certainly there is evidence that, say, following a STEM career, going into engineering, that the payoff is much clearer and more immediate. But there's also a lot of evidence that, at least at the high end, those liberal arts degrees are job training in a different way.
Yeah. Even students who are pursuing degrees that should lead to jobs after graduation are struggling to find work. It's something we've been hearing for the past decade or so. So what's going on?
Well, one thing that I think is going on in the economy is that there is this divergence, and this isn't just a college question. This is a phenomenon in the economy as a whole. So, students who have lots of education, who have lots of skills, they are really benefiting in this economy. Those salaries are going up. The rich are getting richer, but it is at the less educated, less skilled, less high-paying. And that salaries have stayed flat now for a long time. And one of the things that struck me talking to students who were either trying to go directly into the workforce after high school or going to community college is that those less well-paying jobs are not just less well-paying, they're also really unstable at this point. Like a lot of what these young employees would talk to me about was scheduling, that their work schedules were crazy, that they had no control over their work hours, that they would change constantly, and they kind of constantly had to be on call. It was part of the reason why they wanted more education, because they understood that the kind of jobs that were more like they were more likely to get with more education not only would pay somewhat more, but also would give them a little bit more stability in the work life. Mm.
You end the book with the idea that public education benefits all of us, not just those receiving an education. Describe some of the benefits of public education to society and how our views toward the value of public education has shifted.
The thing that really started me thinking down that road was spending time looking at history. So there were two historical periods that I spent time studying. One was the GI Bill era, right after World War II, when President Roosevelt and Congress passed this bill that said that any returning GI would be covered for a 4-year education. And in the debate in Congress, there was, first of all, there was not a lot of belief that these young people would actually take advantage of the free education, because they at that point, college was just for the rich, and most of the GIs were the children of farmers and the children of dock workers, and they weren't the college type, right? And lo and behold, they did show up in college. They did want to go to college. They did want this education, and mostly they did very well. The evidence was that actually the returning GIs, these working class guys, did better in college than the rich regular college students. And so I feel like that was the first time that the United States started to think differently about the value of college. It had gone from being this very exclusive sort of finishing school for the rich to being this instrument of mobility for millions and millions of working class and low income and middle class students. And so in that era, I think this idea that our collective public higher education benefits us all was something that we all accepted. You know, that as different communities would have these GIs come home with college degrees, they would see that certainly their lives got better and they were able to get a better kind of job than they would otherwise. But their increased affluence also changed their communities. You know, the GI Bill in many ways created the great post-war economic boom. It created the great American middle class of the 1950s and 1960s. And I feel like we've forgotten that idea. We've forgotten mm-hmm. what was just an assumption that most people had in that era, which was when your kids get educated, it benefits me, and when my kids get educated, it benefits you. Mm.
You maintain the government alone cannot solve the problem we find ourselves right now in public education. But what do you see as the ways government can be more supportive of public education?
Well, I mean, the big one is just spending more money on it. I mean, one of the most shocking facts in all of my reporting is that on average, we have cut our funding for public higher education in this country since 2001 by 16% per student adjusted for inflation. And that's crazy. That is in mm-hmm. this era where other countries are investing huge amounts in vastly expanding their higher education systems, where all of the signs from the economy and the job market are that we need more and better educated graduates, whether 2-year or 4-year graduates. And yet at that same moment, we are pulling back money, which means that we're getting fewer graduates than other countries. And we are also transferring so much of the risk and the cost and the debt from the public onto individual students. And so that is the big thing that has to change. It's not a very sophisticated or complicated argument that we just need to spend more money on it. But we do. Other countries are doing it. We at other periods have done it. And that is the big problem in this country right now, that our young people are not getting the kind of training they need, whether that is a welding degree or a philosophy degree. So investing more in higher education will make a huge difference. And if we invest more in our public system, our private system will become less stressful as well, mm-hmm. because students will have more options, right? They won't have to just choose between different high-quality private institutions. There will be many more high-quality public institutions for them to consider as well.
What are the important changes we need to see on a grassroots level to not just broaden access to higher education, but support students once they're enrolled and through graduation?
So institutions can make lots of changes to improve the outcomes for their students. So the University of Texas model could and should work anywhere. And some of it is a genuine investment, you know, the kind of internships and scholarships and advisors and counselors that UT brought in, those cost money. But what UT found is that they're a really good investment. But even beyond that, I feel like there are ways, no-cost ways, that institutions and certainly professors, advisors, but even fellow students can do a lot to create that sense of belonging. You know, I think one of the sort of unacknowledged outcomes of this competitive winner-take-all mindset that we have developed around higher education is that even within an institution, students feel like they've got to compete with each other for grades, for internships, for different slots and different activities. And that again is really in contrast to that GI Bill era, where I spoke to a veteran of World War II. He's 95 years old now. His name's Patrick Fay. And he was describing and read this in lots of other places as well, the feel of those campuses in those days when all those returning GIs would show up. And it really was this sort of team spirit in a way that I don't think young people are encouraged to feel in the same way. And so when students are able to cross those lines, cross class lines, cross racial lines on campus and connect with other students, it really breaks down some of the barriers and some of the exclusions that first-generation students feel. So there is a need for sort of big-picture changes and government changes, but it is something as well as simple for a student as just sort of going across the hall and talking to a neighbor who's not quite like you.
The book is about higher education, but I'd love to get your thoughts on preparing for that. You know, parents have so many choices. You know, your public school, then you have, you know, Waldorf and, you know, different private schools and, you know, all kinds of choices out there. What are your thoughts on that process and what helps the students make, you know, be able to get into some of these better schools later on?
Well, I sort of have mixed feelings about it because, you know, for better or worse, it seems like the way that those most selective institutions are making their choices, you know, doing the same, the kind of high pressure, high cost activities and educational opportunities in high school is what they look for. So on that basis, I would say, you know, act like a crazy affluent parent if you want your kids to go to one of these highly selective institutions. But, you know, part of, I think, what the message of the book is that that is not the right way to think about higher education, that we need to ramp down the pressure that we put on the system and on our kids. And so I feel like part of what college is about, and this is, I feel like, another forgotten factor, is finding yourself, is figuring things out. These are like 18 to 22-year-olds. Part of one of the reasons these years matter most is that this is the moment where you are discovering your own interests, where you're for the first time being independent from your family, where you're making mistakes and recovering from those mistakes. So I feel like the middle school and high school years should in some ways be a preparation for that. It should be a moment to experiment, a moment to figure out what you like, what you're good at, and not a time where we're just trying to cram our kids' schedules full of the sort of activities we think admissions officers might like.
And doesn't that, I mean, the anxiety you were talking about from the DC, you know, prep tutor, a lot of that anxiety as parents we're creating because we're saying, well, you got to get into the right school, so you need to do this, you have to do this sport and this extra curriculum. You know, they're trying to build the resume for the kids and not always necessarily letting the kids follow what their own passions might be.
Absolutely. And I mean, what's frustrating about it is that it works, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is a bit of a mixed message when you say to parents, you know, to calm down, because right next door, there's another parent who's not calming down. And the way that the admissions process works, those kids are getting into these schools. So something has to change in the schools, in the admissions process. But I do also think that any individual parent and student can make their own choices about how they want to spend their adolescence. And it was, you know, it was the thing that I saw. Ned Johnson was a great teacher, and he had his students were extremely hardworking, but they did not seem to be having particularly fun adolescences. That way of spending your teenage years, where you're just locked in this struggle to get this particular number to be where you want it to be, so that you can get into this particular institution that you are dying to get admitted to, it is not a particularly happy way to spend your adolescence.
Interestingly, here, you know, on the Cape, we're losing a lot of younger families, which is obviously having an impact on the number of students in the schools. You know, Provincetown lost its high school. You know, we had a story in Truro where there was no students in the sixth grade. I think it was last year or the year before.
Wow.
And this competition with school choice now, public schools are having to have marketing campaigns to try to get students in the door. You have some of the private schools now who have really changed, you know, the availability of how the tuition works so that they can get more diversity. They say more diversity in schools. I wonder if it's just like they're trying to keep the number of students. So in a way, at least for us here on the Cape and Islands, there's a lot more choice that parents have.
Yeah, and it can be really bewildering, you know. I mean, I think I've written a lot about education over the last 10 years and covered the school choice movement in lots of places, in New Orleans and New York and other places. And there is a lot that makes sense about it, right? There's a lot, I can understand why parents want choice. We all want choice in various things. But I feel like the deeper problem is that it goes to this idea of our collective public education. You know, there is this way that that a system in which everyone is in this together and we do not think about education as a consumer good that we have to compete for, it makes for a better system. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's happening on the Cape and in the islands, but certainly I think in the country as a whole, people are starting to rethink that idea of choice as being the highest priority in school, because the idea of a public education system that really works for everyone, I think, is also a real priority. And the reality is that those two priorities are often in conflict.
Mm. Paul Tough's latest book is titled The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. We'll post a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Paul Tough, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks also to Gary Mott and Doug Shugarts for production assistance in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.